We gonna pray for the innocent, cause right now it don't make sense. Right now it don't make sense. Let's talk about Chi-Town. Let's talk about Gaza. Let's talk about Israel. Right now with Israel. Let's talk Nigeria in a mass hysteria. Yeah, our souls are brought together so that we could love each other, brother.
Good morning. I am Julie Handman, the host of Climate Seasons, a quarterly series on climate crisis here in the DC area and beyond. We do deep dives and we look at new solutions. And I'm so pleased to be here today with guests talking about two different topics. So we'll have two segments. And my first segment is reversing climate change, restoring a healthy climate, if you will. And you might think that's sci-fi, but progress is being made, and it's going to be an interesting conversation. Later, we'll talk about building resilience hubs in DC and how one neighborhood is piloting a way to do that. But first, let me introduce briefly my guests for the first segment, Reversing Climate Change, and then we are going to have an interesting conversation to lead into it about something other than climate. So my first guest here in the studio, as it were, is Dr. Paul Zeitz. He is Senior Policy Advisor with the Healthy Climate Alliance. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Wonderful. And he is a physician, an epidemiologist, and a tenacious, energetic, award-winning advocate for global justice and human rights. And I would agree with that. I've known Paul in a past life. So Paul is a doctor of osteopathic medicine and did a preventive medicine residency at Johns Hopkins and a proud father of five sons. And you will hear shortly about a little bit of his work. And my next guest, Christoph Jospe, is on the phone from Seattle. Thank you so much for waking up at 6 a.m.
You're welcome. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for being on the show. And the sound is working. Woohoo. And Christoph works at NORI, where he's on the business development end of creating a new marketplace for pulling carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. He's also a co-host on NORI's Reversing Climate Change podcast, so a fellow conversationalist. And he has a master's degree in environmental science and policy from Columbia University. So welcome again to both of you. I'm going to do something odd, which is to make a left turn right at the beginning of the show and talk about global AIDS. As I said, I knew Paul, recognized him recently. What? You're involved in climate? We used to both work on AIDS, me domestically, he globally. And anyway, I would love, Paul, for you to tell me a short story about some work you did, and you'll see why it's related. Around 96 to 2000, you were stationed in Zambia doing some public health work, and you were surrounded by people dying from AIDS. That was a bad time, and you wanted universal access to the new AIDS drugs that had just come out, not just for people in the wealthier countries. And you fought a battle to make that happen. Tell me that story.
Thanks, Julie. I was living in Zambia, Southern African country. The AIDS Holocaust was happening all around me. Everywhere we went, people were dying. And the response was impotent or non-existent, actually. And the international community was just giving it a pass. They were allowing millions of people to die every year without any effective response. So I came back to Washington and joined forces with ACT UP, Health Gap Coalition, doctors, faith-based leaders, and we created a bipartisan coalition that led to a breakthrough in 2003 when President Bush actually announced the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, and we launched a global fund to fight AIDS, TB, and malaria. 15 years later, we have 30 million lives that have been saved by small investments, strategic investments that had a huge global impact. And it's that experience where I was told it was impossible. I was literally laughed out of rooms that we turned a vision into reality. Not me alone, a whole movement of people. And I would like to believe that that's possible now as we address the climate emergency.
Thank you. And what kind of credo came out for you during that time?
The values that I learned from that experience was that speaking truth was critical, being bold and calling for bold and transformational action, and having a view of serving justice for all. So we have to look at it locally and in our own lives here in the DC Tacoma Park area, but we also have to think about it as a global responsibility, and we're connected to that global community.
Thank you so much, Paul. And I'm so glad you're here. Climate change is like a three-legged stool. The main leg is mitigation, reducing emissions, moving to 100% ideally renewables. The second is adaptation and resilience. Again, we'll talk about some of that in the second segment of this show. Then there's a third leg, going backwards, removing carbon from the atmosphere, pulling it down, storing it. Increasingly, studies show we need this to happen fast, just as bold as Paul was talking about with AIDS. And we are going to talk about that. But I want to turn to Christoph on the phone. There's a lot of carbon up in the atmosphere and a lot of green down here, and we can do more photosynthesis. Is nature up to the task? Is that all we need?
Well, the short answer is yes, and the longer answer is no. I think the way to answer your question is we need to think about the carbon cycle. So carbon moves through different forms, including as a gas in the atmosphere, and the challenge is there's too much in the gaseous form in the atmosphere. So a lot of the people working on climate change reversal are looking at where can we return carbon to reservoirs where it might be in the soils and forests, and I do think nature is up to the task to be able to store enough. And where can we put it in even more permanent forms in geologic formations?
Okay.
And that process actually has been happening for over a very long time scale, sort of hundreds of years, where it's weathering. So when we see some of the rocks changing formations, that's actually a form of nature sequestering carbon dioxide.
Very cool. Now, of course, I want to get into going beyond nature to technological measures. Paul, then Christoph, in general, let's do the 20,000-foot view. We need not just new mouse traps. Some say what we need is a carbon shot. There was a moon shot. There was a solar shot, as some say, in the Obama era. Go for it, Paul, first, yeah.
So we're facing an urgent climate emergency. The amount of CO2 that we've pumped up in the atmosphere is rapidly accelerating global warming. And so there are massive efforts underway to transition to clean and renewable energy. There are large efforts to deal with adaptation, which you'll hear in the second segment. And what we're proposing through the Foundation for Climate Restoration is a massive global effort to remove the 1,000 gigatons of carbon that's already been pumped up into the atmosphere boldly and rapidly. And that will require a Manhattan-like project, a massive mobilization of effort here in the U.S. and around the world.
And Christoph, can you build on that a bit? And do you have your paws on that National Academy of Sciences report or some of those numbers of what we need to pull down?
Well, I'm going to try to keep things optimistic, but there are some challenges because we report that we emit between 37 and 40 billion tons of carbon dioxide a year, but that's actually not counting some of the natural emissions, which are speeding up, like methane escaping and the permafrost melting and forest fires. So it's probably a lot more that we actually have to do. Paul cited 1,000 billion tons, which is a teraton, or 1 trillion tons of CO2, and that's about right to put the scale on the size of the challenge. And then the question becomes, well, how do we do it? And oftentimes in the carbon removal or climate restoration space, it falls into three categories. So we mentioned nature, and ecological ways are great. There are some hybrid approaches that take ecological and industrial, and then there are just straight industrial approaches. And each of these different solutions are at different stages along the way of development, and we need them all. I think it comes down to the simple math problem of there's too much CO2 in the atmosphere, and we need to safely take it out to a safe level.
Thanks. Let's put in the parking lot the hybrid approaches, because I hadn't heard you talk about that before. But can we jump, Christoph, into pulling down carbon dioxide through direct air capture? There are a couple companies that are starting to do that. Can you speak about the very basic, how does that work?
So they're basically like air scrubbers, and they're trying to take one specific thing out of the environment, which is carbon dioxide. So they need a very selective contactor. And what these scrubbers are doing are three steps. They're contacting the air, they're getting the CO2 off the contactor, and then they're regenerating the contactor using the least amount of heat or energy to drive these processes. And so there are three companies who are probably most developed. That's Carbon Engineering, Global Thermostat, and Climeworks. And each of them have different approaches where they take a very dilute molecule, carbon dioxide, and concentrate it to, in some cases, almost 100%. So just to put numbers on that, if you think about what's happening, there's only 400 parts per million or 415 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere, which is a lot from a warming potential, but is very dilute from a in-the-air potential. So you have these machines going from 0.04% to almost 100% concentration.
And we've seen windmills and such. Are we talking about enormously tall things? What do these machines that scrub look like?
So it's not as large as windmills, but it's similar to windmills because what they're doing is contacting the air. So they need to find a way to maximize the amount of surface area that they can contact. So obviously the bigger you are, the better you might be at contacting more air. But it comes down to the challenge of how can you most efficiently get it. So you're right to imagine windmills, but a lot of for the listeners who maybe haven't seen some of the pictures and maybe they're Googling direct air capture now, a lot of these devices come with fans on one end because it's pulling the air through the contactor.
Okay, now we know how it's captured. What about the use? How, for example, is Carbon Engineering using or selling the carbon dioxide they capture?
So Carbon Engineering, as an example of one of the startups, right now has a plant underway that's being built in Texas that will be used to do something called enhanced oil recovery. So basically they're finding old oil wells which get an extra lifetime because when you pump carbon dioxide into these reservoirs, it releases the oil that you couldn't have gotten before. That's actually the largest by far use for carbon dioxide today. Broadly, I think carbon dioxide for uses can fit into foods, fuels, and fibers. So CO2 can be used in greenhouses to enhance plant growth, or can be used to feed algae to make food or other fuels. You can convert it into liquid hydrocarbons, so fuels, just by zapping it with electricity, so via a process called electrolysis. And you can also store carbon dioxide in the built environment, which is some of the work that Paul's directly connected to.
Right. I'm sure a lot of eyebrows went up when we talked about work in Texas using carbon dioxide to get more out of oil fields. Is this just inevitable because of the fossil fuel industry, or is there something helpful that's coming out, that we're learning out of this, or?
I don't think it's fair to entirely demonize the fossil fuel industry, but I will say that for Nori, which is building a carbon removal marketplace, and we have different methodologies that allow people to monetize the removal of CO2 from the atmosphere, we don't accept enhanced oil recovery as a methodology. We don't want to promote something that puts more oil into the environment. Mm-hmm. That said, the machines that people are building and the oil industry, I think, is best suited to optimize and improve these technologies. And if they have an economic driver, which is the price for oil, to figure out how to get really good at removing CO2 from the atmosphere, I think it creates more goods than bads.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so some of the other stuff, less eyebrow raising, food, I've heard beer, you can make, carbon dioxide can help actually make beer. And of course, synthetic fuels, which is interesting. Can we imagine a future in which we've got literally energy created through the carbon dioxide that's emitted through burning fossil fuels?
Right. So a lot of people are working on that. So what's exciting here is that you can make a fuel which didn't come from fossils. So with just carbon dioxide and water, you have the components needed to make a liquid hydrocarbon, a liquid fuel. Now, of course, this isn't carbon removal. This is just saying instead of needing to extract that gallon of gasoline, you can now make it synthetically from the air, which is a great way to mitigate climate change, but not actually reverse it. When we talk about reversing, we need to be able to permanently store it.
That's a very good point. All right, scale up real quick before a musical break. How much scale up do we need? Right now we've got a couple entrepreneurial companies.
Several orders of magnitude. A number of governors and countries are making announcements that say they want to go net zero by 2050, and this is wonderful signaling and recent news, but that's not enough. We need to be net zero now. We need to be removing 1 ton of carbon dioxide for every ton that we put up there, and our budget's already up. And how the technology scales, I think, is still to be determined. To put some practical grounding on us, the plants that are out there today range between 0.1 tons a day and 10 tons a day. And we're talking about a world that has to remove in excess of 40 billion tons a year. So there's a lot of work ahead.
All right, thanks. All right, let's take a break. And when we come back, we will listen to Paul talk about, again, how the company he's working with is looking at sequestering carbon in concrete. All right. And this is Julie Hantman, host of Climate Seasons at 94.3 FM, Tacoma Park. And I'm back talking with now Paul Zeitz at Healthy Climate Alliance. And we're talking about, in general, reversing climate change or restoring a healthy climate. Paul, you are working very concretely on concrete. Can you describe how you want to pull carbon dioxide into concrete, which I understand is one of the most prevalent man-made products around, so that could make a big impact?
Yeah, so there is an explosion of new technologies in this space of direct air capture and carbon capture, as Christoph talked about. They're early stage. There are only a few companies doing it. We're also looking at other ways of capturing CO2 through the development of concrete and other building materials. So there's a company in California named Blue Planet, for example, that is developed a technology to combine CO2 with carbonate and makes to generate synthetic limestone, which is rock that can be used as the aggregate for concrete. Aggregate is 70% of the total mass of concrete. There's cement, concrete, and water. And so the aggregate is the bulk of it. It's a $1 trillion a year annual industry. It's a growing industry around the world. The more humans that we have, the more humans that are becoming middle class and economically robust, want to live in nicer dwellings, have better roads, and there's a big demand for concrete. It's a major contributor of CO2 emissions right now, and so the idea with the Blue Planet technology is to actually go carbon negative by sequestering CO2 in a massive way into concrete and other building materials so that it can be permanently stored for 100 to 200 years.
How is it currently an emitter or, a polluter?
Well, you need energy to produce the cement and the concrete. You have to extract rock from the land. You have to transport it large distances. And the method of producing concrete is burning energy.
Can you tell us a little bit about the airport in San Francisco?
Yeah, so the Blue Planet colleagues at that company worked with the San Francisco airport actually to build a new wing of the airport with this synthetic limestone aggregate concrete. And so that building is up and running. It met all the requirements for building safety, for strength and durability of the concrete. So it was a great demonstration of this technology. The first commercial plant should be open up by the end of the year. And we're also working on how do you scale this rapidly. how do you create demand for carbon negative concrete around the world? And so there could be a new standard that measures actually carbon negativity of building materials that could be introduced. So counties in the U.S., the Canadian government, others are working on how do we incentivize and use the market forces to accelerate uptake of carbon negative building materials.
Did California's legislative ambition play a role, and why is San Francisco Airport doing this? Or in general, in the future, states have a role in pushing the markets as well?
Well, I think that California is probably the most advanced state that I've seen in the U.S. that is really at a statewide kind of policy, legislative, regulatory perspective, taking on the climate emergency. Mm-hmm. And so, and also they're a hotbed of innovation and technological solutions. So it's that combination of tech solutions and enabling political environment that's allowing these kind of breakthroughs to come forward.
Mm-hmm. Christoph spoke very clearly about the rapidity and the amount of work that needs to happen right away. Some people worry, though, that hey, if the concrete industry is on board and we're all doing all this great work to pull carbon dioxide out of the air, are we going to get people saying, oh, it's fine to just release carbon dioxide into the air, someone else is going to pull it down, and we're going to have what is called a moral hazard situation? Is there a moral problem with what we're doing?
I think there is a moral hazard that's already emerging. We're seeing that the energy companies, the fossil fuel companies, are already investing in direct air capture technologies that Christoph described. They're using it to reduce CO2 emissions from coal burning plants and other emitters right now. And it is being used as a justification for continuing to burn fossil fuels. They're saying it's pragmatic. We're going to be doing it. Why don't we at least remove the CO2? So there's a legitimate argument that they have to apply direct air capture to coal plants, for example. But it is a moral hazard if we use it as an excuse not to transition rapidly to 100% clean and renewable energy. And it's a tightrope. We're walking a fine line here. We have to do both. We have to reduce emissions, and we have to figure out how to go to scale with carbon removal technologies at a massive level, way beyond where we currently are.
Christoph, you want to jump in here?
I think in certain circles, the moral hazard argument has become weaker, if for no other reason, exactly what Paul's saying. Now we need to use both. 10 years ago, or even 20 years ago, you might have been able to say, we don't need to remove because we can just stop emitting. But that's too late. We're stuck with an infrastructure that is very carbon intensive. And yes, we need to transition from that infrastructure, but the fact that we can remove a ton that might be emitted elsewhere, I don't think is a moral hazard anymore. It's an imperative. So the moral hazard is actually not to do anything.
Right, right. And it's not a moral hazard to remove
Mm-hmm. Right. I would say it's not a moral hazard to remove. It's as simple as CO2 is like a waste, and we don't want to live in a garbage-less society. We actually pay trash collectors to take our garbage away. So in the same light, you could say carbon removal services are able to take the excess trash that we weren't able to deal with ourselves. And actually the service of that removal reminds you, hey, I should try to put as little carbon in the atmosphere as possible.
It seems to me that there can be legislation to nudge it in one way or another and to incentivize certain kinds of uses of this technology. Does that make sense? And do you agree?
I totally agree that legislation and government has a huge role to play. If I had someone's ear in Washington, D.C., I would say the national labs should be scaling up really quickly and advancing the research and development agenda for all industrial and natural forms of carbon removal. I think that the ideas around state policies with pricing are useful signals, and it certainly is, the government has a major role in getting things right. By the same token, I think the private sector can really lean in and move more quickly than the government. And I think that there's a natural symbiosis between private actors, non-governmental actors, and government actors that hopefully can create a good, positive sort of interacting motion between all those parties.
I'm seeing bills in Congress and efforts by Obama's former energy secretary to put a, millions of federal research. Do you think we're going to see this sometime soon? And what other legislative efforts at the federal level might we see, partly because of the fossil fuel interest in this? Either of you.
Yeah, so there is a broad coalition of actors working on bipartisan legislation to focus on carbon removal. There's several acts that are underway. And I also want to give a quick shout out to Representative Jamie Raskin, who introduced a climate restoration resolution in the House of Representatives. It's the first ever legislative effort calling for a moral requirement that we restore a safe and healthy climate for future generations, with the goal of getting CO2 levels back to under 300 parts per million. So he's the representative right here in Tacoma Park and this part of Montgomery County. And thank you to all of his constituents who have supported his leadership.
And folks who are deep in on climate activism may know the name Senator Sheldon Whitehouse at the federal level. He's on these bipartisan bills. We're talking about people really saying we don't just need mitigation anymore. We need this stuff.
Yeah, restoration and mitigation are both being seen now as important, as well as adaptation. So three legs of the stool, as you said earlier. And it's a new front to focus on climate restoration.
Any last comments, Christoph, since you're not here in the studio?
I think we are in a very exciting time where, if our listener just tuning in for the first time, a takeaway is we can solve this climate crisis. We just need to balance the atmospheric carbon, and there are ways to do that.
Thank you so much to both of you. During the break, we're going to switch out, and you'll hear some more guests coming in. So again, thank you, and I'll mention your organizations again at the bottom of the hour. But thanks to Christoph Jospe of NORI, and thanks to Paul Zeitz of Healthy Climate Alliance. When we come back, we'll have our second segment on one neighborhood in D.C., which is trying to build resilience against climate change impacts. And let's go to our song, The Times They Are A-Changing, in which we know they are.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you've grown. Accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you sink like a stone. For the times, they are changing.
And this is Julie Hantman, host of Climate Seasons. By the way, my website is www.climateseasons.org, where you can find all my episodes and shortly this one up there. I am here now with the second segment of our hour on 94.3 FM Tacoma Radio, speaking about building resilience in one DC neighborhood. And I have with me two guests, Melissa Diaz, and she is climate program analyst at DC's Department of Energy and Environment, DOEE. And she is managing the implementation of Climate Ready DC, the district's plan to prepare for climate change impacts. And before that, she was with the Georgetown Climate Center, which does a lot of good policy work. And she has a master's degree in city planning. Welcome, Melissa.
Happy to be here.
So glad to have you. And our second guest, Justin Leaney, is a Ward 7. There are eight wards in D.C. He's a Ward 7 community activist. He's served two terms as a local, very hyper-local politician, if folks don't know. It's called the Advisory Neighborhood Commissioner for the Paradise and Parkside Communities in Ward 7. And since moving to the community about 6 years ago, he's become an advocate on many issues in Ward 7, and he serves on the board of the Friends of Kenilworth Aquatic Gardens, which is nearby. And I'll stop there. When folks think about adaptation, coastal cities will need seawalls. We all think about that. Resilience, I think, is a broader concept. Right. Looking at Melissa, how can a community persist and even thrive despite risks in the future, harms that may be occurring, and of course, post-disaster or post-threat? And building social capital, building community is one big piece of that. So it's a great opportunity. Now, this is, they're going to talk about the early stages of what is a pilot program in DC. And I'm so pleased that the department was willing to say, talk about this, Melissa, because you'll see it's nascent and it's also really interesting. So thank you again. So Melissa, what are the factors that make an urban neighborhood vulnerable to climate change?
Yeah, so in 2016, when we developed our climate adaptation plan, Climate Ready DC, we looked at climate risks from a number of different angles. So when we're talking about climate adaptation, what we're really talking about is, you know, the city has a number of ways of addressing historic risks. We understand that we always have seen some amount of flooding, some amount of heat, but climate change is changing all of that. So we have to take a more future-looking perspective when analyzing risk. And so figuring out ways to incorporate the projections for the district, which are basically that it is going to get warmer, that it's going to get wetter, and that it's going to get wilder. So the weather is going to become more unpredictable. So we looked at what that means for roads, what roads are going to flood more. We looked at what that means for the utilities. If we have big storms, is it going to create massive power outages? But we also looked at what it means for people. So we understand, for example, that heat impacts the elderly and the young more so than the general population. And so we looked at a number of demographic factors. And then we also looked at what cultural resources are at risk. So understanding that part of a community's resilience is access to the services that they need, to hospitals, to churches, to schools. So we looked at what was in the floodplain. And that's how we identified the neighborhood where we're working.
You sought to identify which are the most vulnerable, climate vulnerable neighborhoods in DC.
Yeah.
And out popped Justin's neighborhood.
Yes.
Yeah. And what is it called?
So we were looking at Ward 7 and a particular part of it, the northern half, where the Watts Branch tributary of the Anacostia River flows and is a major floodplain.
Okay. Now let's go to Justin. Can you describe the neighborhood or the neighborhoods that are in that area?
Certainly. And thank you so much for having me on your show. There are a number of neighborhoods that lie along the Watts Branch Creek. On the north side, you have Deanwood, which is a large, very historic neighborhood. It's a neighborhood mixed of single-family houses and apartment complexes. And then as you get further downstream on the Watts Branch to the lowlands near the river, you get to my neighborhood. That would be Paradise, which is a large apartment complex, and Parkside, which is a townhouse community, as well as Mayfair Mansions, a very historic neighborhood, and Eastland Gardens. These neighborhoods have been around for a very long time with established community institutions, civic associations, and really a history of self-reliance and resilience in their own right.
And primarily African-American.
Yes. These historically and still today are largely working-class African-American communities.
Now they've got self-reliance going for them. Mm-hmm. Long-term institutions. Mm-hmm. Other than the flooding, it doesn't sound like they're necessarily vulnerable. But tell me more about that. You said to me there is strength there, but the vulnerability is palpable.
Right. So these are also communities that are feeling a lot of pressure from changes in the economy. In Ward 7, the unemployment rate is significantly higher on average than the rest of DC. So there's a lot of people who aren't being lifted up by our current economy. In addition, we have a lot of seniors, a lot of young families as well. Families with single mothers, so there's a lot of challenges there as well. And other issues like health care and public safety are always mm-hmm. on people's minds.
And for DC listeners, a lot of inequity in terms of the kinds of services that have ever been there.
Right. Historically speaking, that's the sense from the community is that that the quality of services we get in Ward 7 isn't commensurate with what you see right. west of the river.
And you said no car ownership, few cars.
Yes. My community in particular has only about a 50% car ownership rate, according to the census.
Mm-hmm.
So our people are really reliant on buses and metro.
Mm-hmm.
My community is very heavy bus users, especially seniors. And the way our community is set up, really you have to leave the neighborhoods to go get access to things like pharmacies and stores and that.
Right, right. And it's a floodplain, is the bottom line.
There's a lot of people in the floodplain. I would say, at least in my particular neighborhood, almost 2,000, 1,100 households are threatened.
Yeah. And a few, that's compounded threats. Okay, mm-hmm. let's go to a musical break. Next up, we're going to go back to Justin and Melissa to talk about this project as the community began to identify and is now working to move forward with a specific response to their vulnerability. I'm Julie Hantman, back with Climate Summer 2019, which is the episode of Climate Seasons. My website is www.climateseasons.org. And here on 94.3 FM Tacoma Park and Tacoma Radio. I am here again with Melissa Diaz and Justin Leaney, who are speaking about, in Ward 7, the area of the Watts Branch tributary and the vulnerabilities there. Melissa, I'm going to hand it to you to start talking kind of succinctly about how then you at the department began to move forward with members of the community to say, what are we going to do about this vulnerability to climate and our other vulnerabilities?
Sure. So recognizing that this area was identified as a priority neighborhood facing disproportionate impacts of climate change on the front lines of climate change, we really wanted the solutions for addressing those risks to come directly from the community. So what we did is about a year or so ago, we started a process where we identified 13 residents from the neighborhoods all along the Watts Branch. As Justin mentioned, there are many different neighborhoods that touch this, so we couldn't just go with a civic association that was already there. We kind of had to start from scratch and build the group. And we really wanted to make sure that that group reflected the demographics of the neighborhood, that it was racially representative, that it included younger people. So we had a high school student to senior citizens who had been in the community for generations, had emerging leaders and existing leaders, and got them together and started just talking about what are your priorities. And then we looked at the climate change adaptation plan that we have, and we tried to figure out where there were intersections, and then had that group make recommendations around some of those solutions that we really thought both provided solutions for climate resilience, but also provided solutions for general neighborhood priorities in this part of the district.
Yeah, and why is that? Why not run just to the climate piece of it? What's the intersection?
Yeah. Well, so we recognize that part of being resilient to climate change is being secure in all aspects of your life. So addressing institutional racism, structural inequality, that is climate resilience. If somebody has, you know, job security, they're going to be able to respond better to a climate risk. If somebody lives in a community where they know their neighbors, they're more prepared because neighbors are most often the first responders.
It sounds almost Green New Deal-ish. You can't just talk about climate.
Yeah, and it was really important through this dialogue. I believe that not only did the community participants learn a lot, but I believe Melissa and her team learned a lot as well. It was really important to have these discussions so we could better connect the what community members saw as their needs with what we're talking about with the climate resilience.
Now, it's okay. So over the course of a year, this committee that you got together just said, what do we want to do? And selected one thing, this resilience hub. What is a resilience hub? And it's a bricks and mortar kind of thing. So let's go there.
Well, the EAG's, or the Equity Advisory Group's vision for the resilience hubs is that they were places in a community that were already known to residents, that were already run by community organizations such as churches or civic associations. And these were safe spaces that people could go to during a disaster situation to where they could get information, they could charge their phones, and also these were places that would partner with first responders.
Red Cross.
And they would serve as a platform for distribution of emergency services, medical services, and that they were trusted. And that we are building up capacity in the community, building up the community's own resilience and ability to respond.
So find a place that exists now and turn it into something that serves current needs and can be used in the small but high, small chance, high risk that there is something that happens.
Right. And in resilience hubs, in disasters, disaster services, you talk about blue sky, which is like every day, and then gray sky, which is a disaster. So these are spaces that already have a blue sky use. They're a meeting place for the community. They're a place where people go for summer, youth programming or for job training or just to get together and have meetings. So my thinking as a community member and knowing how people like to stick to their own places they're familiar with, if we can empower a community facility or a community organization that's trusted and known, that people will tend to go there anyway and be comfortable there.
Right. So the first step is identify such a place that's willing to do that and that's known to the community.
Right.
And will there be one in this whole area or neighborhood or many?
So the idea eventually is to have a resilience hub in walking distance of all district residents. We're quite a ways away from that. And so the goal right now is to figure out how to get a pilot. And we recognize that one of the things that makes a resilience hub very different from an emergency shelter or from other emergency resources is that it's designed with the community and all of the decisions are driven by community members. So we're working again with a group of residents this year to make some of those decisions.
We just had a meeting on Monday night and discussed this policy with or this program with community members. And one community member, a former Red Cross volunteer, talked about his experiences in Katrina and said this was brilliant because he spent so much time down there building infrastructure. Every time they moved into a community, they had to start from scratch. They didn't have partners and they didn't have facilities. And he thought this was great.
Right. Create partners now. And I think you said Red Cross can, quote unquote, pre-position certain supplies that might be needed. And you can also have ongoing social services and solve those equity issues. I'm sort of summarizing quickly because we're running out of time. Is there any last takeaway that you guys want to give to listeners?
I mean, I think one of the main lessons that government has taken, so I represent government, is just that working with community is working with the experts. And I think that's something that we forget. People see subject matter experts and then you have to ask people who are really knowledgeable on energy, how you make sure that this hub can withstand and maintain power during an emergency disaster. And while that's a very important question, it is equally an important question of what is going to make somebody show up to this place and use it.
And kudos to DC for trying this out. I believe Baltimore has piloted it. You're looking a little at their model, and there's a couple other cities, but DC's really in the lead here. So thank you so much to Justin Leaney and to Melissa Diaz for this. Justin Leaney, again, Ward 7 activist, and Melissa Diaz of DC's Department of Energy and Environment. And their website is doee.dc.gov. Thanks for speaking today. And thank you to Tacoma Radio for lending your airwaves for these critical conversations. I should add that Christoph Jospe, who spoke earlier of NORI, his website is nori.org. That's NORI.org. And Dr. Paul Zeitz, healthyclimatealliance.org. And also you can see more about his AIDS work at drpaulzeitz.org. That's DRPAULZEITZ.org, which is all one word. And again, my website, climateseasons.org, has all the recordings from past episodes, and soon we'll have this one. And stay tuned for Borderlines with Lady Murr.
When it rained 5 days and the skies turned dark as night. When it rained 5 days and the skies turned dark at night. There was trouble taking place.